Mark, the commission that you worked with here called for some significant changes in secondary education. What would the commission do differently and why?
Probably the most important thing that we would do is change the way students progress through the system, and that would involve changing the boundary in effect between high school and what comes after high school. We would have the states create state board examinations that are syllabus-based, or as some people would put it, curriculum-based, very rich exams. And we would have them set to a standard of what it would take to go into community or technical colleges, ready to do college-level work. We would have those exams available to students to take when they were 15 or 16, and they could take them as soon as they thought they were ready. When they met the first pass level on those exams, they would be able to go, first thing to be following year, to any community or technical college of their choice in the state. They wouldn't have to wait until they were 18 years old. In the report, we predicated that we would be able to send 60% of our kids to community or technical college, at least have them ready to do that, by the age of 16, and 95% by the age of 18. Those who didn't pass it on the first pass would have an opportunity to take it as often as they wished later on until the end of their life, if they liked. The opportunity would never be gone. But as I say, we would hope that almost all would pass it before they were 18 years old.
And what would you hope would be accomplished by changing the system to allow for this? What's the goal?
Almost everybody now agrees that for the vast majority of kids, the senior year in high school was a waste. I think actually, we didn't start from that point. We started from the observation that there are now a number of countries that are sending most of their high school kids off to college, ready to do college-level work at 16. We think we'll never be a competitive country until we can do that. But here's the main point. What we were doing when we put this report together was looking at the structure of the whole system. And it's pretty clear when you look at it that we're a very, very high-cost system producing mediocre results. We're proposing a system that will not be anywhere near as wasteful as the one that we have now, so that we can use our resources much more wisely to produce much higher success rates for American kids. And one aspect of doing that is to take the money that we're wasting now in high school and put it back in at the beginning, so that kids can actually arrive at kindergarten much better prepared to do high-quality work than they are now, and have the support they need in elementary and middle school and the first 2 years of high school, so that by the time they are 16 years old, they will be vastly better prepared than most of our kids are now at the age of 18.
No Child Left Behind has not been well received by most educators, and to a somewhat lesser extent by the general public. With reauthorization waiting in the wings, what would you recommend to our governmental leaders for strengthening or changing the law?
The commission, I think, felt very strongly the basic conception of No Child Left Behind is right, that we need accountability in this country, and No Child Left Behind is a good first whack at that. What the commission said, though, about testing is important. What we tried to do was to design an education system for the United States that is highly performance-oriented, that emphasizes student performance at every point. One of the biggest mistakes you can make is to design a performance-oriented system and get the measure of performance wrong. If you get the measure of performance wrong, that's the performance you're likely to get. And we think that what No Child Left Behind has done is create very strong incentives for the states to use poor quality, low cost tests, which are measuring a very narrow range of student performance and bending the whole system out of shape. From that point of view, we think we would be vastly better off as a country if we had many fewer state accountability tests and much, much better ones. The kinds of tests we have in mind are tests like the AP, like the International Baccalaureate, like the University of Cambridge International General Certificate of Secondary Examination tests. These are all very high quality curriculum or syllabus-based examinations, and they cost more. All of those tests cost between $80 and $100 per test per subject studied. That's about four times as much as the states are currently spending, or even five times as much as the states are currently spending on the state accountability test. So we think the single most important thing that the Congress can do is to reduce the testing requirements very substantially and increase the quality of the tests.
The commission also urged that we send many more of our students to college. Why and what courses of study does the commission recommend?
The commission did not talk about the courses of study that students would take or ought to take in college. What it did was to say, in effect, for little more than we are currently spending, the United States could get almost all of our kids ready for college. That's a different statement.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason it said that is actually very simple. There is hardly a labor economist alive in the United States today who will not tell you that it's almost impossible now for a person to support a family above the poverty line in the United States unless they have at least 2 years of college-level education. In most states now, you can't get a job as an automobile mechanic at a dealership, which is where the decent automobile mechanic jobs are, unless you have a two-year community college degree. That's the reality, and we now are in a situation where about 18, as our report says, about 18 of every 100 kids starting high school winds up with a two-year or a four-year degree within 4 years after starting community college or 6 years after starting a four-year college. We have a long way to go to get to the point where we are producing kids who are able to keep their head above water, that is, above the poverty line, as heads of households. I haven't seen any data or analysis anywhere that I think is at all convincing that's on another side of that proposition.
In your white paper, The Challenge from Asia, you speak directly about China and India's efforts to become educational and economic frontrunners. Can the United States compete with their numbers? And if so, how?
Well, that's a very important question. 100 years ago, the most important economic competitors the United States had were England and Germany. They were the economic powerhouses of the turn of the 20th century. And in the end, the United States pulled ahead, largely on the basis of numbers. They had, on the whole, better education systems at the top than we, but we had so many more people that we simply outnumbered the number of well-educated people that they could produce. Now, there were a lot of other factors at work. We represented an enormous investment opportunity at that time, just as China and India do now. But numbers are very, very important. We think the numbers challenge is crucial. There are somewhat less than 300 million people in the United States. There are about probably just a little below a billion in India and 1.2 billion in China. That's 2.2 billion at least, and everyone expects India to overcome China within a fairly short time. So our total population is a tiny fraction of theirs, really. And when you judge that probably more than half of our kids leave high school with an eighth grade level of education or less, you see that it's actually a minority of our kids who are competing with the best of their kids. So the numbers count. But both of those countries have significant education problems that are not going to be easy to solve. In the case of India, they've had since colonial days a very good education system for the Indian elite. But they do an awful job of educating the ordinary Indian farmers, who are the vast majority of Indians and the slum kids in their cities. Those kids get among the worst educations in the world. And the Indian government doesn't seem particularly motivated to do a lot about improving the education for those kids. So one question that I think is very important for India is whether they can raise the education accomplishments beyond that of a fairly narrow elite. In India, China has a different problem. They've done much better than India, I think, with respect to educating ordinary Chinese. They've made a much bigger effort, especially since Deng Xiaoping, very determined and on the whole quite successful to raise literacy levels broadly in China. But it is still a communist country, and they don't have the kind of open society that both the United States and India do. And you see this coming up in many, many different ways. The chief hiring authority, even in China's very best universities, is not the president and is not the provost. It's the party secretary. You don't get hired as a faculty member in those universities unless you toe the party line. I think this is a real problem for China. It tends to produce people who don't step out of line, who don't think out of the box, who want to know what other people think. I don't think that's going to produce the kind of economy they really want to have, and it certainly won't produce the kind of society that many people in China would like to have. So each of these countries has got significant educational problems to overcome. We'll see whether they overcome them, but in terms of the size of their growing elite, defined by education levels, growing very fast and could easily overcome us in the next few decades if we don't do a much better job of educating the lower half of the distribution in the United States.
I want to thank you for your time. This has been very interesting.
Thanks for the opportunity. You take care.